going to get rolling a bit early here tonight. We have got a long and busy hour, my friends. Good evening and welcome to the first of a very special two-part installment of Life, Liberty, and All That Jazz. I'm your host and commentator, but I won't be commentating too much tonight. I am Jeffrey Bennett. You're listening to this program live on this fourth day of April, 2011, right here on RBN, Republic Broadcasting Network, a marvelous simulcast broadcast between Phoenix, Arizona, Round Rock, Texas, and Argentina. We'll get to that in just a moment. Some quick market reports, because we've not been around an awful lot. Dow Jones Industrial, given everything that's going on with the airlines right now, the big problems with Southwest and the 737 jets are now under scrutiny across the board. Employment figures, the fact that oil has now topped $108 a barrel, all of these things going on. The Dow Jones Industrial closed up 23 points today to end their session at 12,400. NASDAQ flat at 2,789. S&P 500 also flat at 1,333. The global Dow is off a point, currently at 2,205. Oil, as we mentioned, $108.22 a barrel, although in the aftermarket it's down 24 cents. Gold, well, up $4 today to close at 1437. Silver also had an unbelievably spectacular day. In the aftermarket, gold is up, or silver is up 12 cents at $38.71 an ounce. We're closing in on 40. Let's get rolling. The program that you are privileged to be able to participate in or be able to listen to, we ask that there be no callers for this program. I think that with our guests, we may well get to that point, but not tonight. Much groundwork needs to be laid. This is a program that was supposed to air last Monday and Tuesday, but due to international technical difficulties, it was impossible, much to the frustration of listeners and my guests alike. Without further ado, the return of my good friend, the town crier, Roger Sales. Welcome back to Perspectives on America.
Thank you, Jeff. I couldn't be any more happy to be here. And I'd like to address that last point before we start, because I know there's been a lot of people that have been anxious to hear this information. You've waited a week. I've waited 18 years to give it to you. And I did a little post-napkin scribbling here, and that comes out to about 936 weeks. So if you want to multiply the anxiety level, you can get some idea. The first thing I think is to open with a prayer, because this is a solemn moment for me, and I think for the American people and people all over that are listening to this, because you're going to get some real answers tonight. And I'd like to thank God for giving me this information and having the two men that taught it to me that have been so inspirational to me that crossed my path. And Jesus told us that he's the way, the truth, and the light. This is the way to the truth, and I'm going to show you the light. And my prayer would be tonight that he give me the thoughts, and that I'm able to put them into words, and that those words will fall on his people and tickle their ears, and that they will see his face and help us spread this message, because this is the message of freedom. Okay, so that out of the way, let's start with, since we started with a prayer, let's start with some biblical background here. I want to give credit to these two little tidbits to Pastor Pete Peters, who I used to be an avid listener to, and picked up these little pieces of the puzzle out of his sermons from different times. And the first one is from John. I'm not sure the exact chapter and verse, but I'll give you the quote, and some of you biblical people can look it up. And it says, "A double-minded man is uncertain in all of his ways." Let me repeat that. A double-minded man is uncertain in all of his ways. And that is what they've done to all of us. And tonight, I'm going to try and untie those knots, because I'm going to go into a second here what I think their process is. And what they've literally done is tied your mind in knots. I'm going to give you another little story that I heard out of one of Pastor Pete's sermons one night. And I can't give you the book. I know it's an Old Testament story. And he was telling this story in reference to a sermon. And he was talking about the Canaanites or the Amalekites or one of the old tribes, warring tribes in the Old Testament, wanted to go over and defeat their neighbors. And they worshipped Baal. And so they got a hold of Baal, and Baal was walking with them down the road, and they said, we want to defeat our enemy, the whoever they are. How do we do it? And he said, trick them with words. And that's exactly what they've done. They've tricked the American people with words, and they've tied your mind in knots. And that's why nobody has been able to really figure out what we're going to go over in the next two broadcasts here. And I'm going to explain to you at least what, and I'll tell you what's fact, and I'll tell you what's my opinion. This is my opinion, because I've thought about this for many years. If you go back and look at the difference in the subconscious and the subconscious mind carries a great much more information. That's the part of your brain that regulates your body. It tells every cell what it's supposed to do, when it's supposed to do it, and it reacts quicker than the conscious mind, which carries a lot less information, which is the one we run on. So I think that they're playing the differential in reaction time between your subconscious mind and your conscious mind. And I'm going to give you a perfect example, and I think it's one that everybody can relate to. And that's a word, gay. Okay, which for the entire history has always had a very positive connotation of light, happy, and breezy. As they have pushed their agenda forward, and homosexuality is certainly one of the planks of their agenda to destroy the family, is they've taken that word with a positive connotation, and they've attached it to something that most of us find pretty morally repugnant. And now if you turn on TV, which I haven't watched in years, or listened to any kind of regular network establishment broadcast, gay, 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 gay. And what they're doing with that word is they're sending that word into your subconscious, and your subconscious is taking something that has always revolted most people, and it's sugarcoating it with a positive connotation that then affects your conscious mind. I don't know that for a fact. That's a theory I've got, but it certainly works into the things we're going to cover here tonight. So that's just a little bit of background. So now that we've gone to the Bible and we've dealt in a little psychology, we're all going to try and jump back into our second childhood. And in doing that, I'd like to read a little verse out of Alice in Wonderland. And I want to give you credit where I found this. I took a paralegal school when I was fighting the federales at one point years ago. And part of that class for 6 or 8 months, whatever it was on legal research, pretty important topic. We used a book from Nolo Press, which, if I remember right, is from the University of California at Berkeley. They put out a lot of self-help legal books, how to declare bankruptcy and all that kind of stuff. And this was in the front page of the Nolo Press legal research book, straight from Alice in Wonderland. And it says, when I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said in a rather scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, no more, no less. The question is, said Alice, whether you can make a word mean so many different things. The question is, said Humpty Dumpty, which is to be master. That's all.
Powerful words.
I wonder if anybody has ever read that caught that. Now, what's the background on Alice in Wonderland? Alice in Wonderland was written by Lewis Carroll. That's a pen name. Lewis Carroll had a very close friend that was a teacher at Oxford University in England, who was also a painter. And he would come over to Lewis Carroll's house at least once a week, maybe twice a week. You can go read this in Wikipedia yourself. And he would teach Lewis Carroll's two daughters watercolor painting. This teacher's name was a guy named John Ruskin. Now, that name's probably not going to ring a bell with very many of you. It's been lost in the dustbin of history. But John Ruskin was a professor at Oxford. And one of his students went on to be a pretty famous and wealthy guy. And his name was Cecil Rhodes. And John Ruskin is the one that was responsible for teaching Cecil Rhodes the philosophy of recapturing the English Empire around the world that they had lost. Cecil Rhodes went on to go to South Africa and literally control the richest mineral rights in the world. They had a country named after him. The broadcaster that used to have this slot before he hiatused back there to South Africa was from that country. It was called Rhodesia. He also, and this is a little insight into the way these people do things, he also founded, still today, I guess, the biggest diamond mine in the world. And it's called De Beers. And the reason it's called De Beers is because the De Beers family owned that land, and he went in and bought it from them when they didn't know what they had, so he named his diamond mine after him.
Right.
So these are the kind of people that we're talking about here. Also, if you go to that Wikipedia page, it's pretty interesting. There's a big statue somewhere in Central Park. I've never seen it. There's a picture of it there, of a big toadstool. And sitting on it is the Mad Hatter and Alice and a whole cast of characters right there in bronze. Now, I don't know. I've never taken the time to research it. But I would just about bet you everything that I own that that statue was donated by the Rockefellers or one of their foundations. And just like everything else that they do and everything else that we're going to cover over the next couple of nights, it's hidden in plain sight. Okay?
How they do it.
I'm gonna teach you how they do it. I'm gonna teach you what they do, and I think I'm gonna explain to you pretty adequately why even the people that we really, really respect that are pinnacle people in our movement, people like Edward Vieira and Judge Napolitano and people like that don't even understand the information that I'm going to expose to you in the next couple of broadcasts, and it's powerful. Okay. The first thing I want to talk about is the science of law. Now, when I've mentioned that to people in the past, I've had them scoff and say, lawyers, a bunch of lawyers and marbles in their mouth and words mean different things. But if you go back and think about it, law truly is a science. Because if you're going to get into these legal battles where millions, billions, whatever rides on it, you've got to know the exact meaning of the words that are being used. And you've got to know what definitions are being imputed into those words. So when you're talking about exactness, exactness is a science. The science of mathematics, 2 plus 2 always equals 4. The science of biology and how the human chromosome splits and reproduces. Those are all exact and they're duplicatable. And that's what makes law a science, although most of us have never even really looked at it that way. But to tell you that having the exact definitions and the meanings of these words is imperative to your freedom because that's how you've been enslaved. Okay? So as we get into the talk, I had a couple of things that I used to do a bit of public speaking. I used to give this presentation for years in Atlanta. Never could get very many people to listen. I had 11 attorneys go through it, by the way, when I was giving it. Not one of them had ever been exposed to the information. Every one of them went back and did legal research, and not one of them ever contradicted one thing that was presented to them. Now, the little 3-hour presentation that we used to give was a prelude to a 30-hour entire intense weekend legal course in much more depth. And in that national course, we had over 30 attorneys that went through that long weekend course. And one of them from Salt Lake City, I don't even know his name, but he'd practiced over 30 years. And when he got out of that course on Sunday, he went home, he was so disgusted, he ripped up his bar card, and he retired. So that's the power of the information you're going to get presented to you over the next couple of nights. So the first two things I'd like to say is, a good speaker, they say, tells you what he's going to tell you, tells you what he's going to tell you, and then tells you what he told you. And I'm going to do that tonight. And the other thing that I really liked about that I heard about speaking was a good talk is about like a woman's skirt. It's long enough to cover the subject matter, but it's short enough to make things interesting. And that's what we're going to try and do tonight, is keep things in concise. I'm not going to get off on too much tangential stuff. You've got an affidavit on Jeff's website and you need probably to give some of the listeners that don't go to your site or don't know about it that are new. You need to give them that address, Jeff, and you can go pull up that affidavit tonight and you can read it on your own. We'll cover a bit of it, but there's some things you're just going to have to do for yourself, okay?
They can find the website Republic Trade Group International.com. And what you don't know, Roger, is I think the importance of all of this is I'm going to be putting together a special segment on the site where all of this information can be archived, and they'll be able to go there at any time.
Fantastic. Now we're going to jump back in history a couple of thousand years, and we're going to go to a Chinese general named Sun Tzu. When I first got into this, I had no idea who this guy was, and I was raised in a military family. Okay? Many of you don't know who he is, but I can promise you this. Every conqueror in the history of the world since him has read his book and followed his protocols. And the one thing I'm going to tell you about Sun Tzu was one of his final statements. And he said, if you don't know your enemy and you don't know yourself, you have no chance of winning any battle. And I guarantee you, we don't know our enemy, and most of us don't know ourselves either. All right, and we're going to shed some light on them tonight and in the next couple of nights, because the information that you're going to receive is, I think, after all the years of thought and study I've put into this, their deepest, darkest secret. And I'm going to tell you why I say that. Because to be able to carry on the agenda that they're prosecuting today all over the world, they had to literally take over the United States of America, because the United States was one of the only free countries in the history of the world where men received God-given rights. And they had to come in and squash that, because as Prime Minister Gladstone made a speech in Parliament in England, he said, if we don't do something about the colonies in this country, they threaten every monarchy on the face of the globe. So they knew full well the implications of our country and its founding principles. And they also had to come in there and teach a bunch of free men who were very studied, because they studied Blackstone's commentaries. And it was the second most read book in the colonies behind the Bible. And they knew the common law inside and out, and the king couldn't pull anything over on them. And so they had to come in and take this country and turn you into a whole herd of sheeple that they could then fatten up through materialism, which they've done with their monetary tricks, and take you to the slaughter. First of all, because you're industrious, and because you had all these freedoms and ethics and morals, and secondly, because they had to destroy you, and they wanted to use the U.S. as a platform for all this research and development, and all this militarism, and all this monetarism that they've exported all over the world with their chicanery. And they had to take down the country. And it's my thesis that what you're going to learn is their deepest, darkest secret, because even people like Edwin Vieira and Judge Napolitano don't know what you're going to know after these two broadcasts. And I think it's a very, very important point, okay? And it is no coincidence, as we all know there's no coincidences out there, that, back to Sun Tzu, that the Mossad's motto is, by way of deception, we shall make war. Because that was Sun Tzu. That's classic Sun Tzu. If you're strong here, make them think you're weak there. If your enemy's over there, make him think you're here. If you're this, make him think you're that. Everything is deception. And it's all in your mind. And they've tied your mind in knots. And I'm going to do my dead level best to teach you how to untie them, to teach you how to regain your freedom, because there's a remedy in this. And for all of you to be torchbearers and carry this message forward, because the subject matter we're going to cover in the next two nights is going to give these people some major, major problems. It is no coincidence, again, that 6 months after teaching this information, that my two mentors were raided in Las Vegas, Nevada, with 27 armed special agents from the IRS with M16s, held them at gunpoint for 8 hours, would not even let them go to the bathroom, and they left with all the files, all the computers, and everything else they could carry.
Okay.
Now, they don't do that kind of stuff if you're not a threat to them. If you're not a threat to them, like Phil Marsh, some of you old-timers will remember Phil Marsh, they let Phil Marsh go for 5 years out there teaching his untaxing tactics. Because what they do is they let you go, and they just like a fisherman with a net. They let all the fish come into the net, and then they go and bust Phil Marsh, and they get all of the suspects in his files. But it's the people that have the goods that they want to squash the knowledge. And that's exactly what happened to us. And thank goodness both of those boys are out of federal prison. So we touched on the passport application last week for a minute. I was doing a little bit of additional study, because I'm doing a little bit of additional writing for an offering of this that we're going to offer you folks. Now I have here, not the one online, I have in my hand the hard copy that anybody can go pick up at the post office. Okay? And there's two copies there. One of them is an original application, and one of them is an application for passport renewal. And right on, this is the orange, that's the original one, and this one's a little bit dated. It's from back in about 1996 or so. And right at the top, it says, U.S. passports, in bold letters, U.S. passports are issued only to U.S. citizens or non-citizen nationals. Each person must obtain his or her own passport. I heard on a radio show one time that only about 15% of the people in the country have passports. I'll bet you that a bunch of this listening audience has one before too long, and we'll go into that more. I want to read you another little part here. This is in the instruction part. It's under the paperwork reduction statement part, and it says, you're not required to provide the information requested on this form unless the form displays a current, valid, OMB, that's Office of Management and Budget, number. We try to create forms and instructions that can be easily understood. Get this next sentence. Often, this is difficult to do because our citizenship laws are very complex. Anybody ever tell you the citizenship laws were complex, Jeff?
Yeah, they did.
Well, they told you right here. Well, I read this to one of my mentors today, and he said, yes, they're so complex that when you try and go out and teach the people how complex they are, they send you to federal prison. So, which is exactly what happened to those guys, and God bless them, okay? So, let's get a little bit into law here. I'm going to give you some background so that you'll understand. We'll all be on the same page. And if you don't have a pen and paper right there, I want you to do this in your mind's eye, all right? So you can just, I'm going to give you a formula. And the formula is simple. It's R plus D equals R. Now that's the formula of the law. And what that means is rights plus duties equal remedies. Okay? So you're given rights and you're given certain duties. Maybe other people are given duties, but they're correlative. They're together. You never just get rights. You've always got duties associated with the rights. And if you get a right trampled on or somebody doesn't uphold a duty, there's a remedy. So right there is your whole formula for the law. R plus D equals R. That's very important. There's a reason that that's the first thing we covered. Okay? And what we're going to do now is go into a few words, and we're going to cover legal definitions because we're not going to do too many of them, but the ones we're going to cover are real important. And the first one is property. Now, when I say property, I'm going to probably bounce some questions off you, Jeff, just rhetorically, okay, so I don't feel like I'm sitting here talking to myself. When I say property, and you automatically think, well, is that car out in front of your house your property?
Well, of course I would think it is. I paid for it.
Okay. Well, certainly in a colloquial way, that is correct, because that's the way we use that word. But in a technical way, in the science of law, property is a right. Okay? And in the law, the car is called a thing. And your property is the right in and to control and ownership of the thing. Okay, does that make sense?
If I lived in Atlanta, if I was to
drive to Hartsfield International, you know, in Atlanta they used to say if you're going to hell, you got to go through Hartsfield. If you were going to go out to Hartsfield and park my car out there in one of those lots, and I was going to take a plane up to New York City, and I was going to meet somebody up there in New York in the bar at LaGuardia or one of the airports, and I could take that title in my car, in my pocket, and we'd meet over a drink, and I'd sign that title over to them, and now they've got rights into the property, even though the car's all the way back in Hartsfield. Okay? So do you see what we're talking about here? It's an important concept to understand. A property right is the right of ownership and control in and to the thing. It is the only way a property right to a thing can be exercised is through a person. So is the property thing clear? It's not necessarily the thing in law, it's the right of ownership and control in and to the thing. You with me?
It makes sense.
Okay. Well, now we're going to talk about the other one that we ended that on, which is person. So when we say person, and you see person somewhere in a regulation or a statute, what are you talking about? You know, if you go back to business law, back when you were in college or high school, if you took that, and they'd say they had a real easy definition of corporation. They'd say a corporation can do anything a person can do. Okay, because this is important. I should go in a corporation, the rights and the duties are separated. You see, the corporation has the rights, but if the corporation tramples on your duties, then you can't put the corporation in jail. You can fine it, but who do you go after? If you go after a corporation, you go after the board of directors. It's the board of directors that have the duty. Okay, so in a juristic person, which a corporation is called, the rights and the duties are separate. All right, and if we're talking about a real flesh and blood person, we call that an individual, and you'll see that in law sometimes. And the reason they call it an individual is because rights and duties are contained in the same entity, and the word individual comes from the word indivisible, because you contain both rights and duties. All right, so a person is an entity to which the law ascribes rights and duties. A law dictionaries, or many dictionaries today, if you go look up the word person, you're going to see what a person is. You're going to see it's a corporation, a partnership, a this, a that, or the other. They're not going to go back and teach you this. It's an entity to whom the law ascribes rights and duties. And I'm going to tell you a story, because my mentor, a guy named John, lives up in Salt Lake City. As he was doing all this investigation into this stuff, and he's been studying law since he was a kid just because he loved it, all right? And he called the University of Utah Law School, and he got the dean of the law school on the line, and he's talking about this concept of person. And he said, what course do you teach that in? And he said, we teach it in a course called jurisprudence. And he said, it's an elective course. And John said, oh, really? So when was the last time you taught it? He said, 6 years ago. We only teach the course when we get enough people volunteering that want to take it. So yeah. What does it take? 4 years to get through law school?
I guess.
Is that
so.
Right? There's a couple of classes that went through law school that never got exposed to the legal concept of person. And all laws are written for persons. Think that might be important? This is what the Black's Law Dictionary definition of person is. This is pretty revealing. The scope and delineation of the term is necessary for determining those to whom the 14th Amendment of the Constitution affords protection, since this amendment expressly applies to persons. It is a concept that, as we go forward, is ultra important to understand. So as we get this stuff up and people can go back and listen to it, I know a lot of this is going to go over people's heads. Okay?
Well, they're going to have to wait until we come. Not, you're going to have to wait until we come back from the break. Roger Sales is our special guest and speaker tonight. Stay with us. We will be right back.
Nothing I can do, or nothing I can say.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
In times like these, you can't depend on the government to keep you warm and fed, but you can depend on the Vermont Bun Baker to do just that. With the Vermont Bun Baker, you'll never be in a situation where you can't cook, bake, fry, boil water, or heat your home all at the same time. One of the most revolutionary cook stoves, wood stoves ever, the Vermont Bun Baker is available with or without soapstone veneer, a natural stone that retains heat and radiates it back into the room once the fire is out. A beautiful addition to your home, the Vermont Bun Baker has an efficiency rating well above 75% and qualifies for the wood stove tax credit. For more information, watch the Vermont Bun Baker on YouTube and live stream, or visit us at www.vermontwoodstove.com. You can also reach us by calling 1-866-SOAPSTONE. Don't ever be hungry or cold because the power's gone out. With a Vermont Bun Baker, all you have to worry about is what's for dinner.
This is an important message from HempUSA.org. For our listeners who are advancing in age, baby boomers, and to all who want to be healthy, we urge you to try our microplant powder and see the difference it makes in your life. Please visit HempUSA.org and read about microplant powder. It's easy to take, one heaping tablespoon in any liquid three times a day. Call 908-691-2608 or visit HempUSA.org. Please inform your family, friends, and relatives about this incredible product. It can change your life if you give it a chance. So try microplant powder today. Call 908-691-2608. In this toxic world, microplant powder can help now in cleaning out heavy metals, parasites, viruses, fungus, and bacteria. Please download our catalog at hempusa.org today.
Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. If you are ready to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself, then you're ready for Heart and Body Extract from Healthy Hearts Club. Heart and Body Extract has a 23-year proven track record of using certified organic herbs that make up an excellent formula to balance and support the heart and circulatory system. In as little as 2 weeks, you can feel amazing results when your 2-month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to hbextract.com.
Come on, guess I took go walking on the saddler's street. Just get ready to be right up the sunny side of the street.
Oh, we're going to make it the sunny side of the street because it's time you get exposed to the darkness. Welcome back to tonight's Life, Liberty, and All That Jazz. Our special guest and commentator, really, I'm turning this program over to him because what he's got to say is far more important than any babble I could give you. So let's go back to Roger Sales. Thanks once again for being with us, bud.
Hey, that's my pleasure, buddy. And, yeah, we're going to try and walk on the lit side of the street. It's
that's
sunny
it.
Over there. The next word we're going to cover is probably the most dangerous word in the English language, and that is resident. Resident this, resident this. Are you a resident that? What's your legal residence? Where's your residence that you reside? Okay, so we take, once again, just like property here, most of us think that that means where you live, and certainly that's a colloquial definition that's imputed to that word by virtually everyone. But we've got several other types of definitions for that word, and one of them's a legal definition. The first one's geographical, in or at living in some place for a length of time. The other one is political. And it says, living in some place for the receipt of a benefit and the discharge of a duty. Now, that's like the resident in medical school, because we all know a guy goes through pre-med, he goes through 4 years of medical school, and he goes into his residency. And that's where you go to the hospital for about an hour a day, and you look at a couple of patients, and you go out and play golf and make about $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year, right? No, not right. That resident stays at that hospital. Sometimes he doesn't even get out for 2 or 3 days, and he probably sleeps on a couch when he's lucky enough to get some sleep. And that's the discharge of a, for the receipt of a benefit, the discharge of a duty. Now, there's even a further definition of resident that's not listed in your dictionaries, and that comes from ministerial law. That's ambassadorial law. And that means an ambassador in residence. And, you know, these countries do contracts and agreements and treaties on exchanging ambassadors and stuff. So let's use an example. I think Jeff stepped away, so I can't use him as a sounding board. But let's use an example of, since I'm in Argentina, let's say that the Argentine ambassador flies up there to D.C., and when he's going through Dulles Airport up there, they found a kilo of cocaine in his diplomatic pouch. Are they going to arrest him on the spot and try him under American law for possession of a narcotic, illegal substance? No. They're going to send him back to Argentina, and hopefully the laws there, here in Argentina, will prosecute him. Why? Because he's a resident. And that means that another country's or area's laws apply to him. And this is the meaning that's imputed every time they ask you the question in any kind of legal capacity, are you a resident? And that is one of the biggest landmines in the English language. And we're going to get into that, because the first place in the Constitution that the term and the word resident is used is the last word in the first clause of the 14th Amendment, and the state wherein they reside. Okay? So the next one we're going to talk about leads to jurisdiction, and the word we're going to define and talk about is allegiance. And allegiance is nothing but another word for jurisdiction. The first rule of government, and this is from a law case called U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark, is allegiance for protection and protection from allegiance. The word and that definition actually comes from the feudal era, and before that a little touch of Roman law. Another way of saying benefits and duties, allegiance for protection, protection for allegiance. If you look at the word jurisdiction in Black's Law Dictionary, the Black's Law Dictionary definition of jurisdiction is the state of the forum. Okay? The next one we're going to talk about is the word subject. Now, England has subjects, and England has a monarchy, a king. I'm going to read you a short excerpt from that very same case, U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark. This is a case from the 1890s, all right? This particular quote I'm going to read you is from page 469. If you're a legal beagle and you want to get the cites, it's listed on the affidavit there on Jeff's website. And I'm going to tell you that you may, from those of you who have been real astute, you may have heard of this case, or it may ring a bell with you. U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark is the case that every one of the Obama birthers have used, because it is the pinnacle case in the entire history of the United States Supreme Court that covers citizenship, denizenship, how you get your citizenship, and all of that stuff. And that's why all those people have been using it in this Obama struggle on his birth certificate. So let me go into what it says in Wong Kim Ark about the word subject. And it says, this is a quote, "The only adjudication that has been made by this court upon the meaning of the clause and subject to the jurisdiction thereof in the leading provision of the 14th Amendment is a case called Elk versus Wilkins, where it was decided. That decision was placed on the grounds that the meaning of those words was not merely subject in some respect or degree to the jurisdiction of the United States, but completely subject to their political jurisdiction and owing them direct and immediate allegiance." So, the term in the 14th Amendment, "and subject to the jurisdiction thereof," means not merely subject in some respect or degree to the jurisdiction of the United States, but completely subject to their political jurisdiction and owing them immediate allegiance. What did we say? Allegiance for protection, protection for allegiance. Another way of saying rights and duties. They give you rights, you owe them duties. The next thing we want to talk about is slavery. There's several variations of slavery. You know, our establishment media and our controllers go to an awful lot of trouble to make you think that the only slavery in the world was black slavery in the United States. And that's not true. Okay? There's been slavery since the beginning of time. Man has always wanted to enslave his fellow man. You got Spanish peonage. You've got Chinese coolies. You've got the black slavery that we all know about only too well. And then you've got the European variety of slavery. And it was called the feudal era. And those people were called serfs. And there was two types of serfs. There was involuntary serfs that were born into slavery, or serfdom, if you will. and there's voluntary serfs. Now, if you go back, and those of you who are Monty Python fans will remember one of his movies was called The Holy Grail, In Search of the Holy Grail. And in that movie, they had an oath of fealty. And that's how someone would volunteer into slavery in the feudal era. When you'd volunteer, let's say the guy's in happy old London, he's got a nice family, the economy gets bad, he can't make it, so he's got to go out to one of the feudal lords and say, I want to be your serf. Well, if he volunteered into it, they would go through this ceremony called an oath of fealty. And what they'd do is they'd get the lord of the manor there, and the guy that was volunteering into slavery, which is exactly what it is, would have all of the other serfs, or at least enough of them around to witness the ceremony, and he would swear allegiance to that lord for his body and all of his worldly goods. So he literally swore an oath of himself into slavery. Now, the good thing for him was that when the economy got better down in jolly old London, he could volunteer out and go back into his old job. And the witnesses around witnessed that ceremony. And when he did that, he literally put himself in a position of slavery where that lord owned his body and his worldly goods. And the contract, because it was a contract, was that he would give him a certain amount of land for him to till and oversee, and that the lord of the manor would have an agreed on percentage of whatever output that was. But you see, to be able to take that output legally, they had to own him. And the reason for that, I'm going to mute myself and cough here for a second.
Sorry, I'm here listening.
We'll go back to another guy that's got a pretty good reputation and did quite a good body of work, and his name was Adam Smith. And Adam Smith was the founder of all economic theory. His book, The Wealth of Nations, was the wellhead for what we today call both Keynesian economics and Austrian economics. Most all economic thought in the world came from Adam Smith. And what Adam Smith said, and I got this out of another Supreme Court case, by the way, it said a man has to own and control his labor because it's the only way that a poor man can, of his own initiative, change his status and raise himself up into another class from a lower class. Another really important concept to understand is that if you don't own your labor, somebody else does. And if they own your labor, they own your body. And if they own your body, you're a slave, Jack. I don't care what other color you color it or however you look at it, all right? We're talking where the rubber meets the road here.
All right, math, Matt. Allow me to ask a quick question here.
Sure,
equation, if I'm understanding this, is that, in effect, if someone else owns your labor, they own you as...
That, absolutely.
Which, in effect, is what our taxation system is about, correct? Or am I getting...
Oh, man, you're transitioning right into my next point. Thank you. This was not rehearsed, okay? So I must be doing a good job, all right? I used to have a theory when I was selling, and I just sold most of my career, was it's easier to pull a rope than it is to push a rope. So evidently I'm pulling a rope pretty good tonight.
All right.
The question I was going to ask next is, why do you think the IRS files a lien at the property office in the property roll books? You think it might be because they consider you to be their property?
Yeah, it's the only thing that makes sense to me.
Okay, so if they file one of those bogus liens down there on you in the property thing, what about if you rent your house? Because they put your name down and they put the address down, don't they?
Yes,
but they
do.
Can't come seize your house because you don't own it. But they can go in and steal your car. They can go in and garnish your wages. They can clean out your bank account. They can do all that stuff, can't they?
Yeah.
So when they file a lien on whatever address, whether you own the home or not, that lien's not on the house, is it?
It's on you as an individual or a person, whatever the choice of words are.
Well, let's use a real explicit one, as a slave.
Okay.
So those of you who say, and I heard Neil Bortz say this one day, I used to live in Atlanta, I used to listen to that clown all the time, that we're in economic slavery. Let me tell you what, kids, you're not in economic slavery. You're in real, honest-to-goodness feudal slavery. And as we go through this program, I'm going to prove that to you beyond a shadow of a doubt. Okay? So, the next... Oh, by the way, while we're talking about words here, let's go into another one. How about terrorism? You heard that a lot the last few years, haven't we?
Oh, boy, have we ever.
Well, it's just like Rush Limbaugh used to say 20 years ago when he was first getting started. He had a campaign there for months, and he'd go, words mean things. Well, you know, Rush is right. Words mean things. All right? So if you want to go to terrorism and you want to look up the definition, what's the best dictionary in the world, Jeff?
Black's Law.
No. The best dictionary in the world is the Oxford English Dictionary.
Oh, all right, all right.
And if you go to the library, you'll see there's about 13, 14, hell, maybe 16 volumes there. It takes up a whole shelf. And the reason the Oxford Dictionary is considered the best dictionary in the world is every word they cover, they go into the etymology of a word. And you can go look up a word, and it'll give you a whole litany of every time that word's been used and where it came from in the important meanings and the origin of that word. So it's a very important resource. So if you go to Oxford English Dictionary, and you look up terrorism, what do you think the first definition is, Jeff?
I keep going. I'm not sure.
Intimidation by government.
Ooh. That's in the dictionary? They've not taken that out and hidden it?
That was the last time I saw one, they hadn't. Okay. Man. I don't see too many of them down here, and the ones I do see, they're in Spanish. So, you know, it's not exactly my forte yet. So, terrorism is intimidation by government as set forth in the French Revolution. We should expand on that just a little bit. What do you think was the first example, the first Petri dish for these monsters that are trying to control the world? After they did the Illuminati in 1776 and Thomas Weisskopf and the guy on the horse got hit with a bolt of lightning and some of the manuscripts got out, where was the first place they tried their little theories and ideas? The French Revolution. Okay.
Let them eat cake.
Yep, you let them eat cake. Now, by the way, you know that wasn't cake. Cake in that day meant the stuff that comes out of the inside of a coal or wood-burning stove. So, we'll go back to our definitions here. How's our time doing, Jeff?
We're okay. We've got about 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, I've only covered, you know, a little over one page, so I guess we're doing good. The next one we'll cover is license. Okay? And in Black's Law, again, judicial notice goes straight into evidence. License is described as permission to do that which is otherwise illegal. So, are you telling me that it's illegal to drive unless you have a license, right? Well, that's what we've all learned. Was it illegal to get married for all these centuries without having a license?
Nope. When did that stuff come along?
I'm going to tell you where the history of that was. The marriage license was actually, the idea was fermented in the state of Virginia. And the reason they came up with that was because they had a law in Virginia which made misogynist marriages illegal. That's marriage of a black and a white. And if a black and a white wanted to get married in Virginia, they had to go to the state and get a marriage license because otherwise it was illegal. And evidently somewhere along the line, the Rockefellers or some of these creeps thought that was a great idea, and they figured they'd put it on all you slaves out there. Okay?
Hmm.
You got to get a business license, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So all those licenses apply to things which should be a natural right from God, but now you got to go apply for them and ask for them for the government because it's illegal. Why do you think that might be?
Well,
you don't think it might be because they don't own you and control you, and you got to go ask permission, do you?
Well, it's that, and it's also revenue income. It's income for them. It's revenue.
You know, what we've learned over the years is these guys never do one thing that doesn't accomplish multiple objectives. They're real good at that. Okay. So, now let's go back and let's study a little bit in specifics about the feudal era and the feudal structure. And this is very important. Okay? It's the English or the European variety of slavery. It was bought over by William the Conqueror, by the way, when he came over, I think it was in 1066, and he conquered England. He brought that over from France. He was from France. How many times have you heard different authority figures refer to the global feudal system that's been instituted all the time. I hear people refer to it all the time. Okay? In fact, last year, on just about a year ago, in another week or so, and you can go back in that other network's archives, and you can go listen to this show. And I would actually encourage you to do so, because on April 15th of last year, Alex Jones had Paul Craig Roberts on for an entire hour. He had retired, and he came back out of retirement to do that special show. And that entire hour was on the institution of the worldwide feudal system. And one of the things that stuck in my mind that day, and if you go back and listen to that broadcast, you'll hear it, and you'll hear it verbatim. And he said, but you can't do anything about it. And that's not true. You can do something about it. And that's what I'm going to teach you folks over the next couple of nights here. Okay? So, two main types of serfs. One was the involuntary serf. We touched on him earlier. The other was the voluntary serf. Have you ever heard the term, Jeff, or any of the listeners out there? Have you ever heard voluntary compliance?
Oh,
like,
sure.
Our tax system is based on voluntary compliance. We had
oxymoron.
Absolutely. Well, not really. We had a whole thing with RFID chips that said, oh, your compliance is voluntary. So don't you think those two words are oxymoron kind of sounding?
Of course they are.
What if they're not? What if they mean that you volunteered in the system, and once you're in the system, you've got to comply? How about if that's how it means?
All right. So what you're saying is that if you opt out of the system, you no longer have to comply?
Move to the head of the class.
Ooh.
Involuntary serfs were involuntary by birth. There was only one way to get out of slavery in the English feudal system if you were born into it as an involuntary serf. And that way was that if you were a bastard. Because if you were a bastard, there was at least some modicum of a chance that you were fathered by the Lord of the Manor. And if you prosecuted that point and you didn't know who your mother and especially your father were, you could get out of slavery that way. Okay?
Interesting.
Yes, it is, isn't it? We talked a little bit about the question.
No, it becomes more interesting because for all the years you've known me, you know how much I enjoy teaching history. And that is what makes this one even more interesting to me, is because we begin to realize that the state that we happen to be sitting in today, and I don't mean North Dakota and Virginia, et cetera, but the position that we as Americans sit in today, it's historically, it goes back hundreds of years. So it's like an ongoing experiment.
Actually, thousands of years, if you really wanted to research that
right
back. And, you know, this is something I've thought about. We're getting towards the end of the hour here, and I'll kind of stop the definitive stuff for a minute because I don't want to miss a transition for tomorrow night. But I do want to tell you a couple of stories, and these are things that I've just thought about because this has eaten up my life for 18 years. I think about it just, you know, constantly for 18 years. That's why this is such a pleasure talking to you people tonight, because this, I consider this to be my life's goal and my major life's accomplishment, okay? And that's I've accomplished some pretty big things in my life in my past, and this one dwarfs them all. So I am very privileged to be bringing you this information and explaining it to you tonight, okay? But I wanted to say, if you were the guys that were going to take over the world, and you were going to institute these kind of systems, would you go out and dream up a whole new system and worry about all working out the bugs or the things you hadn't thought about or other contingencies you never even dreamed of? Would you do that? Or would you go back in history and find something that had worked for, as you said, hundreds, maybe even over 1,000 years? Wouldn't you bring that system forward because it was tried and true and proven, and just change a few of the words around so that nobody knew what the heck you were doing?
Absolutely. Makes life a lot easier.
Okay, it sure has made it easier for them, and it's made it miserable from all you people, because they've hidden it so darn well that nobody's been able to figure it out. And I'm going to explain to you how my mentor started figuring this out, because if you don't think God's at work here, you got another thing coming. okay? Mm-hmm. Because this guy loved the law since when he was a young man. You know, I get they're Mormons, and I guess when you're in the Mormon religion, you go through a thing like a bar mitzvah for the Jewish religion, where you know come of age. And I don't know what the ceremony's called, but I remember John telling the story. And when he was a young man, and the elder came in, and they lay hands on you, and they supposedly can see your future. And what that guy told them was, he said, people will come to you from north, east, west, and south to seek their freedom. Heavy?
Yeah, very
sure, heavy.
Heavy
to me,
listen,
baby.
We're down to probably the last 2 minutes. Let's wind this one down. Do keep in mind, Roger will be rejoining us tomorrow evening, and we will pick up. Let's go ahead and wind this one down, and this has been an amazing hour, my friend.
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you the story. He'd been studying law for years. He got absolutely interested in this, in the IRS stuff and the taxing, because if they've got two Achilles heels, it's the financial system and the taxing system. Those are the two linchpins of their whole system, okay? So if you study either one of those in any kind of depth, you're going to pretty well find out fairly quickly that there's a skunk in the wood pile somewhere. Well, John was living in Denver. He was in the University of Denver Law School back in the old English law book section, and you know, if you've been in a law library, especially in the older parts, the aisles are real narrow. And as he turned around to put a book up, his elbow hit a book on the opposite aisle, side of the aisle, and the book fell out of the shelf and it fell open on the floor. And he looked down, and what caught his eye was it was on this old English feudal system and the way that they would go back and seize if you were a debtor, okay? And the things that he read were the things that they couldn't seize. They could seize everything else, but they couldn't seize your work product, etc., etc. And he'd studied tax law enough that he said, that's the exact same stuff the IRS can't seize. And that's where this started.
Wow. Well, this is where it ends for tonight. Roger Sales, we made it through an entire hour from Argentina without difficulty.
Yeah.
Those
that.
Of you bums out there who want to muck with the technicalities, put it to bed, because we ain't going to quit until we're done. Roger, thanks for being here with us. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being patient, giving us your valuable time tonight till the good Lord sees fit to bring us together again without apology. I am Jeffrey Bennett.
Baby, what you got, nobody has.
Gold ever climbs to a free fall. How long before it hits rock?